Welcome to the Tech Vittori podcast, where we will explore the hottest topics in connectivity and digitalization with some of the industry's leading minds. Please welcome Build Fast, Fund Smart, Fight Differently. We'll be shaping the defense technology landscape. There's so many dilemmas. For example, how do defense planners navigate the dilemma between investing in next-generation technologies versus the proven ones, the heavy metal? So, is the digital solutions fragile? How we make sure that they're not? So, investments in heavy conventional assets versus sleek next-generation technologies, as mentioned, and governments remaining the primary and often only customer. So, is there some bubble going on in the defense finances and investments? Moderator of this absolutely great panel will be Tomas Bildegovic, Advisor of Security and Resilience to the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Latvia. Please welcome.
Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. I'm glad to see that we have so many survivors after lunch. This is always a challenge. It's also a delight to see how much this forum has grown over the years. This year, I think the fact that we have the top senior leadership from the European Commission, from NATO, from the OECD, all here, I think that really speaks volumes. I'm also glad to see that the defense industry, the military industry, is so well represented here. Of course, militaries and governments, and I think that this is a very natural segue to what I find to be perhaps one of the most important panels of this entire forum, our conversation focusing on defense tech. So allow me to very briefly introduce the brilliant speakers we have here. To my immediate left, we have Armands Meirants, who is head of R&D at LMT Defense. Then second, we have Udis Norītis, who is Undersecretary of State at the Latvian MOD. Then we have Warren Lowe, who works on command, control, and communications policies, capabilities, and industry at NATO HQ ACT. And last but not least, Timothy McGuire, who is the European lead at HAC4 Defense. So I think we have a really versatile range of perspectives from government, from industry, from the research side, from the activist side. Udi, let's begin with you, since you are the sole, you have the fortune and misfortune of being the sole government representative on this panel. Latvia, of course, is one of the NATO member states to have committed to investing 5% of GDP in defense already next year, not the 2030 or 2035 Hague target next year. I must say that at the MFA, we're quite envious. We can only dream about 5%. I think the same is true for other ministries. But of course, we understand that security is the priority above everything else. Without security, there is no prosperity, there is no anything. So tell me, Udi, with this surge of investment in defense, what role, what is the vision for investment in emerging tech? And what is the balancing between these traditional, conventional assets and systems versus emerging tech?
Just thank you, and thank you for inviting and giving a chance to explain how the MOD sees the technology, and of course, how does that goes together with the defense budget, of course. I think when the question comes to the convergence or the balance, we don't see that as a binary choice. It's not the one or the other. To find a balance, that's the question, of course. And I think it's also important that we are very clear about how we see the new technologies. The fact that we buy a hard metal, sophisticated, expensive weapon systems, doesn't mean that those are now not new technologies. We of course, are devoting almost half of the biggest defense budget we have had in the history for the investments and development of the capabilities. And all of the new weapon systems we are procuring have the most advanced technologies. The question when it comes to emerging or the new technologies, which are, again, in different stages of development, what we have understood, of course, it's a difficult, and I think the first step is to recognize this difficult debate when it comes to the user of the equipment, which is the armed forces. And by default and throughout the history, the army is rather conservative when it comes to new technology, not because they don't want it, it's because they want things which are battle-proven for decades. The problem is it's difficult to talk about new technologies and that like being very having a long history and a log file with success. So what we have understood is we have to do it in a diligent, pragmatic, and nuanced way to find specific things where we want to invest, not to just go to the army and say let's embrace the new technologies. They are willing to embrace things which help them operationally. And that's I'm great that Warren is also here. We have the experimentation together with LMT, of course, not to do it in a synthetic environment, to do it through the exercises, to really see what the units need, and to have not only the staff officers, giving their opinion about the technology, but the users themselves on the ground, so the troops can get them closer. And again, it has to be done in a diligent way, and again, to embrace it, not to overblow it, but we, of course, are very open to everything what the international and the local industry is offering. Still, we are a bit binded by the EU regulations, of course. EU is kind of working on that to ease all of it, so the nations can do the innovative procurements easier. One thing I want to emphasize is that from the MOD perspective, we are devoting more resources for the innovation, so the companies can come with the new products. Again, specifically designed for our armed forces. We have signed a number of R&D agreements with the companies, which have I also seen here and this event as well.
Again, do you have any sense of percentages of what percent of funding is?
Percentage-wise, when it comes to the research of technology and or research of development, depends how you define it, we want to move towards 1.5% being from the defense budget being devoted to that. In real terms, more than 20 million in the years to come, which is still a small number, both percentage-wise and money-wise, but much, much, much more than we had before in the previous years. We want to do it in a nuanced way again to cover the things which are not covered, for example, by the EU funding. So it's more about military equipment, where the companies can't actually through the EDF or other instruments get the finance from other supporting mechanisms. We also want to emphasize the fact that we are, of course, devoting more resources and more people for our innovation unit, which is the technology center and the drone excellence center, which, again, we see as an important element to have that convergence and to have they are, I would say, the champions we hope that will manifest the technology within the system, within the armed forces, but also help the industry. So the industry have more access to the testing grounds and also to the users, and more opportunities for them. So that's a couple of quick points from my side. Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I could not let you rest just yet, but a very brief follow-up. You mentioned the issue of procurement and sometimes, having these quite stifling rules that prevent investment in higher risk ventures. Or, of course, the other challenge of, state audit office or European auditors, EU auditors, kind of breathing down the neck of policymakers, of officials and ministries. Could you discuss this challenge and whether you feel that this is something that is very actively shaping the work of the MOD? Or
I would say I think we've been much more assertive and even, to use the word, aggressive to use all the possible exemptions there is in all the regulations, not because we want to do it, because there are certain things we can, not to say circumvent, but we can actually use in our advantage. Specific regulations which concerning the national state defense interests is the one clause which actually allows us to do the exceptions. And we've been much more assertive throughout the years, last 3-4 years, when the defense budget has increased significantly, to use that clause so we can do the procurements easier. Because if we would do it in a classical way, we would definitely be behind the schedule. So we don't, we're not afraid anymore to, when we find a product which we really want, to go for it. There's still some paperwork needs to be done, but I think what we have gotten also from at the ministerial level, from the cabinet of ministers, if we can come up with something which we really want, both for the user side and MOD side, there are actually mechanisms we can use. So definitely, and that's the reason why I also wanted to emphasize, is that why we offer specific funding for the industry from MOD perspective is because, again, to not be burdened by the EU regulations, because nationally, of course, we can be much more flexible on how we help investing and how do we support the companies. Mm-hmm. So the long answer to the short question is, I think we're on a good track, and I think the EU as well will come to their senses and be more easy in the future as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Warren, perhaps we could turn to you. You are based at NATO ACT, tasked very broadly at preparing alliance for challenges and threats on the horizon, perhaps even beyond the horizon. So looking into the future and understanding how the alliance can maintain its technological edge. So perhaps you could offer your perspective on how does NATO view the development, adoption, integration of new and emerging technologies in defense, and how do you ensure that this process is not severely behind the actual process of technological evolution?
First of all, Thomas, thank you very much for inviting me and to be with this distinguished panel members as well, some friends as well. And to address your question, let me start first with the overall, NATO view on this area of emerging disruptive technology innovation in general, because you mentioned I'm from headquarters SAC-T. It is one of the two military by strategic commands, so we have a very military-centric view, but I want to start at the top, perhaps. So, NATO, since its founding in 1949, has been very interested in exploiting, technologies to defend its member nations and also to be effective in operations. And there are examples of organizations or initiatives have been stood up since 1952 to do that. But more recently, in 2021, the defense ministers came up with this plan to foster the use of dual-use technologies, ones that traditionally are not military-centric, to be used in a military context. But also, at the same time, there was an idea that we need to protect NATO and the member nations to the effects of adversaries using emerging disruptive technology as well. So there's a security component that NATO basically committed to back in 2021. So since that time, there's been a number of, dedicated policies and implementation plans across a number of different technology areas. And these should not be surprised to anyone that artificial intelligence appears on that list. Biotechnology appears on that list. Hypersonics appears on that list. We see that being used by, adversaries in Ukraine almost on a daily basis. And of course, the area that I'm interested in is the next generation networks. So the 5Gs, the next generation SATCOM. So there are very specific, publicly available plans and policies on those. So with that in mind, there is now a renewed emphasis to accelerate the adoption of these technologies. So there's more energy now in the alliance. So because of that, there's been new initiatives that have been stood up to foster that. One example is the Defense Innovation Accelerator for the North Atlantic. And I know my fellow panelist, Tim, is well-versed in that since he was in the spot for Diana. And that's a catchy, acronym, DIANA. And also there's this multi-sovereign venture capital fund that has been created to the tune of $1 billion to foster startups and, dual-use or non-traditionally military companies to, come into the military space. So we have that the setup there as far as from 2021. But even more recently to the summit in 2025, there was a renewed, let's say, acceleration pledge that was made. It's the action plan, the Rapid Adoption Action Plan. So what's different from that, from previous statements about innovation, is that there's time limits now with this action plan. There's a target of 24 months from problem to actually deployment adoption. That's pretty quick, 24 months.
Within these NATO mechanisms.
Yes, yes, that's correct. And these are targets, of course. And the interesting part, too, is that it also has a component, because there are a number of enablers in this action plan. As you might expect, as the let's say Udis mentioned about the procurement side, making procurement more agile and providing training on how to do that, and also doctrine, creating use cases. Where does these technologies fit into the greater way that NATO will operate militarily? And then finally, of course, is the demand signal. We have a lot of startups, but where do they actually then sell their products to make these happen? There's now a connection to the so-called NATO defense planning process, which is capability targets that are levied across, let's say, NATO as a whole. Each nation, let's say, chooses a set of targets it wants to implement, and some of those targets could be partially associated with innovation. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the technologies are in there as well, such as ships, tanks, which I think are absolutely necessary. As you just mentioned, it's not binary, but we have to do all of it, because certainly the threat calls for that. So that's the NATO umbrella. Now, for us in ACT, we support that initiative. We have Diana within our events, and we have next week the Digital Backbone Experimentation. I'm not going to go into detail because my colleague and fellow panelists probably will, which is supporting that, let's say, informing on how we should actually use the technologies. Because since NATO is 32 sovereign nations, we have to have a common understanding of what these technologies are, and DIVACS is one way we do that. So we have other, let's say, initiatives as well. Some may have heard about the Task Force X. It was, let's say, initiated by our commander, General Vandier, to provide better situational awareness in the Baltics. We've all heard about the Shadow Fleet and so on. So within a couple of months, they basically contracted out. There was an RFP on the streets where industries responded. So this is a chance for industry to come in and actually show how they could deploy these autonomous systems to provide a maritime situational awareness. So that's an example of providing a kickstart to push ways of using autonomy in a responsible way to help to, let's say, progress and provide security to our nations. So those are some of the examples, and we can certainly go into more if you like, but let me stop there so that we can
thank
the other panelists.
Thank you. Not to get too bogged down on the issue of procurement and tenders and so on, but maybe also passing it on to Timothy. So this morning, in the fireside chat with the Executive Vice President of the European Commission for Tech, Ms. Henna Virkkunen, there was this example mentioned critically that a Latvian startup fairly recently received funding from the EDF, but the procedures that came after receiving this funding took at least a year, even over a year, until R&D could actually get off the ground. So not to get, you know, put all the analysis based on this one example, but perhaps you could comment more broadly on the European experience with this. What is Europe getting right in integrating and adopting driving investment in innovation, and where are our existing mechanisms still holding us back and undermining our competitiveness?
Well, I think it's moving in the right direction. I think that's safe to say. I think the question is at speed. So I mean, speed is everything right now. Kind of what fellow panelists mentioned earlier. When we're thinking about defense specifically, it's about understanding what the requirements are, and it's very difficult for a private sector to understand what that product market fit is. It's very difficult to build for militaries that don't communicate what their needs are. And what's relatively unique about defense is the monopoly hold that governments have over what that what those needs are. My entire background is government until very recently. I still look at this as more of a civil servant and from a military role, but our needs, we need to communicate more clearly to communicate to communities that really don't understand what defense does. Now, understanding that government is the buyer here, government is the customer, like with the NATO Rapid Adoption Action Plan, creating these innovation ranges and test centers and demonstration events like DIVEX, these are opportunities to bridge that gap really and move forward at speed. These are I'm kind of twisting your question a little bit, but any opportunities we have to really bridge these cultures that don't talk to each other, I see as a win. How do you do that at speed? So more iterative, lower barriers of entry. You do that enough, and it de-risks that. They feel more comfortable communicating what those needs are together. So it is difficult doing business in Europe. It's a very fragmented market. Even the Baltics, you put all the Baltics together, that's not a serious market if that's all your market is. So scale is absolutely everything, and that's a critical role for NATO. So where do these pieces fall into each other? We have a sense of urgency in Europe right now, especially since the full-scale invasion. So don't let a crisis go to waste, I suppose. And this is not it's not a bubble. It's a recorrection based on peace dividend for years. So the defense budgets are correcting. We're playing catch-up right now across Europe. We're taking lessons learned from, I'm American. We're trying to bring lessons learned from the U.S. that we've been in a state of war for a very long time now. So what lessons learned can we take, but not copy and paste, but how do we adapt those to Europe, like non-traditional contracting practices, and how do we work with a commercial ecosystem that is more used to having those interactions with defense end users, like myself when I was U.S. Air Force. Did I answer your question?
Yes, Udi, not to put you on the spot, but I thought it might be interesting for you to reflect on Timothy's point about militaries not sufficiently clearly or sufficiently transparently communicating their needs to industry and the government's responsibility there to serve as some sort of conduit. What has the Latvian experience been in this regard?
I think it's a talk. It's another monologue, of course, and I think it's just not, I'm not saying those like just theses, like just put them on the table. I think it's a default setting we have to understand, and there will be technology which one or the other military will not be willing to put in their equipment, and that's fine. The question, of course, from the industry perspective, again, I understand the industry. If they have produced something, and I don't know, the other countries are buying, and if we're not buying that, there is that, bad feeling about it, why we're not doing that. And we have had cases about it. We're saying, well, it's the fact that something is produced doesn't mean we'll buy it because we just can't afford it. And again, we'll be happy to buy everything we don't have, even though the 5% devoted, almost 5% devoted to defense. I'm sorry, the capabilities and the procurements are not about the percentage, it's about the volume. And the volume for us is still a bit more than 2 billion, which is huge for us historically. But it's still not a lot, and I think it goes back. We can afford some of the capabilities. And the question here is, of course, if I talk nationally about the industry here, is we still have a small defense industry which is growing, and we are looking for those new products, the new emerging technologies which they can offer, because we will be happy to buy the infantry fighting vehicles from the Latvian company. We don't have it here. We don't have anyone here. We will not have it because it costs billions to come up to that kind of product. I think it's a constant dialogue which is needed, and we do it. We have a different kind of formats where we put the industry together with the users, and I think which is important when it comes to new technologies that, as I said, we have the R&D contracts. We also have a grant, a specific grant program, where we invest in the technology which is not as ready, and I think through those processes we can come up with something. And the last thing I want to just emphasize is that the military is bad at accepting the failure by default. The government, the public money is not for failure, but I think that's the, again, one incremental part we have just to remember. it's in their DNA. We are not here to fail, not to test for failing, but we want to like emphasize we have to do it, otherwise we don't have up with a good solution.
You mean failure of a system?
Of technology. Of technology. Yeah. It's fine if we test, it's fine if we invest money and it fails. We're not losing that, we have lessons, but it's difficult. It takes a bit more time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a fascinating point. Armand, to bring you in more from the technical side, we've already heard the digital backbone mentioned multiple times, the 5G testbed. Could you talk from your perspective, from the industry perspective, how these projects have evolved over the years, and maybe why are we having this discussion here in Latvia? Why is Latvia a suitable place to talk about these issues?
Yes, thank you for having me here first. So in terms of the industry, of course, we have grew up to the different points, and like 2020, we started with assumption that commercial or dual-use technologies maybe will not be as a part of military technologies at all, specifically for the mobile network technologies talking to. We also saw that 5G at the beginning, we can say, was over-marketed. Like there was a lot of promises about the functionalities, which actually we see a lot of them happening, but we are missing some promises from those times. And when we started, it was very important to get hands-on experience on the technology, and to do that together with the stakeholders, national forces. So from an industry point of view, we see huge add-on that we have those European-level projects, European Defense Fund opportunities. We have cooperation with the NATO. We are very happy that NATO digital backbone experimentation have been hosted here in Latvia. This year will be fourth time in a row. So. That gives us a lot, first of all, for us as an operator and industry representative. We can heavily do experimentation together with the stakeholders, do integration on the level with different partners, which is hard to achieve alone without the supportive, let's say, mechanisms. And I can agree that, of course, sometimes with the research and development projects, the EDF was mentioned as an example, sometimes there is a situation that you are like putting ahead a proposal, and then you wait like 1.5 years when you can start to do your work. It is a challenge because nowadays, of course, speed is most important, as it was mentioned in the panel as well. So, but there is a different ways how you can approach that. You can also look on those projects a bit on the agile way. So you adjust the goal of the project when it comes a bit, and you do adjustments during the project as well. Because when it comes to the state-of-the-art technology, something new, adjustments are needed on a very regular basis. But overall, yes, I'm very happy, and we as an industry can say that supportive mechanisms which helps to do experimentation, demonstration, prototyping together with the stakeholders, representatives from national forces, NATO, and so on. So that's very important for us to understand what is needed, how the technology need to be customized, and very important to grow in the right way. Mm-hmm.
I would be happy to take one or two questions from the audience in case you have something pressing. If not, then I can continue, but perhaps somebody has something urgent they feel they need to ask.
By the way, you have opportunity just to put up your hand, and I can give you a mic, and you can ask also from the audience or comment, maybe. But yes, we have a question. If NATO Innovation Fund invests in dual use only, how can we credibly persuade banks to invest in lethal military technologies?
That's a quite spicy question. I like that. Maybe Warren and Timothy, you can...
I want to steel man this a little bit. So, I mean... understanding just how government works, it took so long to establish the NATO Innovation Fund. It took about roughly 2 years or so in committee to get that approved, to get 24 member countries to agree to the fund. So it being focused on dual use, the world has changed a little bit in that time. So, I mean, I do believe pretty strongly that's going in the right direction. It takes time. And as we're, I mean, I don't know where you want to go with this next, but the focus on dual use, there are other initiatives that are focused on defense, and they're quite literally moving more into defense adjacent topics without being too specific there as well. I would also like to remind like how important dual use is, because you know, everything, you could do anything short of kinetics or weapon systems, and that's majority of what governments buy typically. Like it can, most of what governments buy is still not in the kill chain.
I think from a dual use perspective, the reason why it's so attractive is because there is a market for that. I mean, there's several billion mobile handsets out there, so 5G is so lucrative in terms of use cases, as far as a typical soldier might accidentally leave his helmet or his canteen, but he won't leave his cell phone, or she won't leave the cell phone behind, because we are tied to that. So I think that's why, as you, I think you mentioned, one of the panelists mentioned about the small, relatively small size of the military marketplace in comparison to the, let's say, the commercial market space. So it's great when we have, let's say, partnerships with the big telecom providers, Nokia and Ericsson, for example, because they see the potential in the military market to, let's say, expand into that space and to, of course, support defense. So I think short of kill chain, as Tim is saying, we have that untapped potential. Of course, we need to make it secure, because that's the first question everybody's going to ask. Is it secure? Is it jam-proof? And is it really, let's say, suitable for the military environment? But I think the war in Ukraine shows that they're using everything in the toolbox to make that connectivity happen. So if a military radio is not available, maybe 5G is, or 4G LTE. Or commercial SATCOM, so that resilience and survivability has to be built into the system, and tapping into the dual use area is I think an important way to mm-hmm. go in that.
So actually, I think we can turn to taking some lessons from the war in Ukraine. Of course, Ukraine has the most relevant experience in countering Russian aggression broadly, but also resisting non-conventional attacks, integrating various lower-cost technological solutions. Maybe, Udi, first with you. Latvia is one of the flagship projects in defense, but also in providing aid to Ukraine, is its co-leadership of the Drone Coalition. Could you talk about how this project has enabled Latvia, but also NATO allies to learn from Ukraine's battlefield experience?
One of the ideas when we initially came up with the idea to set up the Drone Coalition was actually that. Of course, the first primary objective was to help the Ukrainians to get more drones and get more nations behind, and I think overall it has been a great success when it comes to the support we Ukraine has achieved through the Drone Coalition, and I remember the first day how it started and where we are now. It's all about the drones, if you ask, when it comes to different kind of gatherings, how to help Ukraine, of course, but not only that. But the idea behind what we also have is a bit more mercantile, if you wish, was to get the lessons, to have the Ukrainians here, to see what's working and what's not, and also to get access to their knowledge in Ukraine. And of course, again, I would just turn it a bit different. There's a bit of an overhype about the drones. I will be very open and candid about it. It's a very potent technology. And again, a drone is it's a, such a wide kind of say piece of equipment that we kind of very often, I think, underplay the both the benefits but the cons of that as well. I think we are very pragmatic about it. We really try to identify the lessons first of all, then to see do we want to learn them or not. I think through the testing of the different drone systems which are produced by the Latvian industry and being given to Ukraine, but also what the other companies are offering, because most, if not all, the testing for those systems are done in Latvia and in a SALIA training range, of course. And that's the important thing where we have understood is that that's one of the niche things we can offer, is we have a dedicated space to do the testing, the demonstration, in conjunction with electronic warfare systems. So that's one of the things we have found a good cooperation and a good facilities, and not a facilities, but a good place, which is lacking in Europe at the moment. From the lessons, I think what we have understood, and that's all over the place, I won't tell you anything radically new. The technology changes so fast. And what I said in my one of the previous interventions I have, Ukrainians, of course, because of the situation they have, they are not afraid to fail. They accept the failure. They accept that not all the products will work. And again, you learn something from that. And I think that's the biggest lesson we try really to learn, is that it's fine if the system is initial phases, it's not working, or it's not needed at all. It's completely fine to accept that we have invested time, resources, and people. Except it's fine that it's not working. Again, just the important thing is just to move forward on how to advance the systems. What the Ukrainians are doing, amazing. And they are giving that linkage that we talked about, how to ensure the Ukrainians are pushed to do it. We're not there yet. We're not fighting the war. So I think that's one of, again, a natural kind of obstacles or elements we have to keep in mind. But I think the biggest lesson, of course, is that we can't, when it comes to new technologies, we can't really look to those systems as something, I don't know, compared. I like the comparison of F-35, the fighters, which, you know, or the F-16, which has been in the service for, what, 50 years already. When it comes to new technologies, we probably can't look at it like that. We have to see how they can adapt, how can they can change. And again, that linkage with the user is incremental and essential. And again, it's important, and it sounds very natural, but it's not like that. Without it, we can't expect that the industry will come up with something, as Armand said, something we will upload and buy in the next day. It's on the shelf. So I think that's, again, what we can learn from Ukraine. I think are more of those elements. I don't want to talk about all the battlefield experiences and how they're doing this and that. I think there you need a separate conference for it. But I think from the industrial and technological perspective, I think that's the most important thing, because it's working in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Armand, very briefly, same question to you. From the industry perspective, what sort of innovation, partnership, innovation, cooperation have you had with partners, stakeholders in Ukraine, and have you been able to adopt and integrate lessons from their experience in innovating, in building resilience, building security?
So what we are learning already starting from the war is all the experience of Ukraine with the communication technologies, of course. And as I mentioned before, there was a doubt, will mobile network technologies will be on the battlefield, but with the Ukrainian it's pretty clear now that SATCOM technologies, commercial SATCOM technologies have been used, and also mobile network technologies have been used, including the commercial networks, private networks, tactical networks, 4G, 5G. So all that is used in the war, and basically there is a separate sub-war in those technologies who will be more successful. Also, as we saw, that one of the highlight for the war spider operation, there was a very important rule for the commercial network technology, and that means that also from our side we need to learn, understand, and move forward with some processes, technologies, how to work in that situation, also from nation point of view, like what operator should do at that point, and what we can do at all. So because advisories actually can use our network as well against us. So we are learning a lot of in terms of the communications, and we are trying to be in the close contact to also do joint testing and share the views, and also try to forecast the next steps which need to be done. And the temp is very, very high, because, I mean, what is new for today for Ukrainians, it's like 3-4 months, and it's already not new thing, and both sides are using it. So basically, that's the reason we need to be up to date all the time, and we try to cooperate with them and talk a lot.
Timothy, I wanted to come back to something you said in your first comment, talking about the challenges in this region challenges of scale, challenges of market size, and so on. A bit of a gloomy remark, one could interpret it as such. So what I wanted to ask is, so what would be your, I don't know, your proposal, your suggestion, your vision for how the smaller countries like Latvia or like the Baltic states, what sort of niches should they position themselves in? What sort of approach should they take when it comes to defense tech and innovation?
Part of what I've come to appreciate about defense generally is it's foundational, and we're all in the same team. Like, we're all in the same alliance. There's enough problems to go around. I don't see any need for competition. We all need to be more transparent about and clear with ourselves about where we fit into the ecosystem. Everybody has a role. I think there's an opportunity. I mean, there's challenges and opportunities with all of these things. It exists somewhere. So, it's with the increase in defense spend, we're all pulling our own weight, but we're working within the fragmentation that is Europe. You have political alignment, you have even economic alignment in some areas, but not necessarily on the industrial level. I'm working off of principles. More is always better. The more you can communicate larger eventual scale and larger total market size to investors, the better for that. And some of the challenges with integration, investors don't understand how these concepts of operation work. So like for border surveillance, for example, like where they choose one capability rather than multiple capabilities and understanding the nuance of how they fit together. Like it's more complicated than that. So as everybody on the panel has said, the opportunity here is amazing and inspiring, because this is where the sense of urgency happens. This is where we can take the lessons learned from Ukraine, work more with more agility, and then be able to scale those to other parties as well. While the nuance there is how do we keep those jobs locally, how do we keep the technology there, but that's a responsibility of every local ecosystem. So, for example, it's a pipeline. So budgets are increasing everywhere for defense. We don't want to be testing the same way necessarily Ukraine is. And hopefully the war will end at some point, and then we won't have that as a test bed. So where are we going to replicate that as real-world conditions as possible? This is pretty close to that. So, I mean, that's an opportunity, and that's excellent. And that's something that the rest of the alliance doesn't have as much access to. So that's a strategic advantage here locally. That answer your question there.
Yes, thank you. I think on a final round of, I would like to use the final round of questions to ask a somewhat populistic question based on something Warren kind of mentioned at the outset of the discussion. Of course, the different lines of effort when it comes to emerging tech, biotech or autonomous systems, AI, 5G, 6G, quantum, and so on. Let's say if you were a leader of a small to mid-sized European government and you stumbled into a pot of money and you had to direct it into one high-risk, high-reward innovation investment, where would you channel it? I think let's start with Warren.
I think I don't want to say it's an easy one, but I would say if I could have two answers, it would be communications and cloud services. Why? Because that provides you the platform for, it's like building highways. Once you open up a highway, imagine if there was a ring road around Riga, and I didn't have to go through Riga to get to the airport like I do when I come here. That provides, let's say, more rapid ways for people to move, increases economic benefit. So the communications, the fast communications, wireless, mobility, if you invest in that, I think you have the capability to provide those services to people, and opens up commercial, of course, defense. But the cloud computing is the other important part in terms of the resilience it provides and the platform it provides for software developers to then create solutions that could be used rapidly in times of war or the defense. So those would be my two answers.
Mm-hmm. Armand?
Nothing else as communications, of course, but if really I believe that communications is tying up everything, because at the end, for the modern warfare, it's either those are drones, sensors, phones, radios, all of them need to be connected, and that's the way how you can get the best situation awareness and also do the best actions. So basically, connectivity is like a backbone of everything, so it's my belief, and I would choose the connectivity, of course.
I don't give straight answers. I'd probably say energy. So, I mean, it's not, I think you want a defense, but it's easy to say things like quantum or AI or big transformational kind of technology areas. I'd say energy because everything, that's really the backbone that really all communications are run. That's what allows for societal resilience. That's what allows for manufacturing capacity as well. If we have more total energy in the space of all kinds, yeah, that's my answer.
Uji, you're the one with the checkbook, but you can answer in your personal capacity if you wish.
Yeah, a difficult one. I was really puzzled how to answer that. I think, and I think Tim just gave a kind of good point. I think at the end of the day, it is about still the basics of the military maneuver, if you wish, which will be this deciding. Communications extremely important, but at the end of the day, you still need the units to move around. So I like the energy point. I like anything which will help us move faster and destroy the enemy faster than they can destroy us. And it comes to different kind of kinetic elements of the energy, but also how to ensure that the platforms can just move faster, fly lower, avoid electronic warfare, jamming and all of that. I don't want to come up with a silver bullet, but I think anything which will, you know, be the new F-35 or the B-2 stealth bomber will be the thing. I don't know what it is, if you ask me, but I think we probably could output something still which concerns the kinetic element of the warfare.
Well, thank you very much. I have to say I really enjoyed the discussion. I hope it wasn't too much grilling. Thank you all for contributing, and let's have a round of applause for our speakers.
Well, then we have just a few questions left. Just in case you want to speak into the microphone at least once in your lifetime, just put up your hand and you will have the opportunity. Until then, the question is Europe hesitant to invest properly in lethal hardware and tech because it hopes the war in Ukraine will magically go away?
Excellent question. I think maybe let's start with Warren.
So we started, as Armand's mentioned, we started digital backbone experimentation 4 years ago. And at the time, it was purely a communications-related exercise. But then we figured out that, you know, the whole digital backbone initiative in NATO has started that connects sensors to decision-makers and effectors. So we need to have the digital backbone come to life for the operational, let's say, users. So we started thinking we just can't show them that we can have a cell phone communicate with another. We have to show something that's more militarily relevant. And so the slow movement to digital backbone experimentation to more kinetic kinds of applications because of the unique features of, let's say, 5G networks and others, it becomes very obvious. So I think we're moving in that direction. Our commander in ACT has also talked about increased lethality. So that's the direction we're taking to make it the digital backbone relevant for the user.
Maybe Uji?
Quickly, I think a provocative question. I think it's fair enough. I think we have to respect, as gentlemen said here before, it's not easy to get through the processes and agreements through any international organization. So I think we have to appreciate and accept what the EU has done. The EU has done a great job, as NATO has. We want more, for sure. And yes, we all want not to spend on defense, trust me. We won't want, you know, to give money to health sector, to agriculture, to education and science. Yes, we're not there yet. And I think everyone, of course, is looking how it will move forward, because if we want to build up enormous war industry, we will have to feed it afterwards as well, and we have to accept it and agree that that's the fact as well. Mm-hmm. So I think we would just, let's better appreciate where we are. We are in the EU where I don't think we would have thought we would be years, 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Maybe one
more
question?
So we're doing what we can. That is the answer.
I think we have to just exploit the chances we still have more and not to expect what will not happen. I think we have to be realistic about it.
And then we can hope that we just don't know what actually is happening.
No, of course, I think that's fair enough. I think the fact we have to understand, and we as a nation, the Baltic states, wants the EU and NATO to be different than it is, and some other states want it to be different as well. We have to accept it. We might not like it, but that's the fact. So, because what other choices we have? We don't have any other instruments in the Europe or in the world which can really thrust upon.
Thank you. Any other questions, please? Well, in case you meet our speakers out there at the break, please ask also the questions we just didn't have time to ask, but they did have them on Slido. Thank you very much. Thank you, honorable moderator. Thank you. And the panelists.